me it was going to be quick, but I didn't know it was going to be that quick. I'm Jen. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 11th, 2005. My home group is the Jaywalkers home group, and we meet in Richmond. It's called Bon Air. It's on the south side of Richmond on Tuesday and Friday evenings. On Tuesday we have a speaker, and on Friday we have a beginners meeting and then a big book meeting, and we have babysitting at all of our meetings. And I do have a sponsor, and at my home group, we say whether or not we have a sponsor and when we last spoke with our sponsor. So I have a sponsor and actually talked to her 2 days ago. I really didn't like that when I first went to that meeting, because I thought they were trying to check up on me or embarrass me if I wasn't doing what I was supposed to do. But sometimes it is nice to know that you're doing what you're supposed to do, too. I want to thank you very much for asking me to come here, and I had such a nice drive out here with my friend Janice. It's just beautiful drive. The weather has just been great, and I always look forward to coming out this way and seeing the people I know out here. On the way, I talked to Billy this afternoon before we left, and I was checking on if we were leaving with enough time to get here, and he said, you know, I said, how long does it take? And he said, an hour and a half, sometimes an hour and 45 minutes, depends on traffic. So we were coming out 231 behind this big tractor, and I didn't know that that's what he meant when he said so it was a little slow going for a little while there. Alcoholics Anonymous has really given me a life that doesn't look at all like any kind of life that I've ever planned for myself or imagined for myself. And even still sometimes today I think, I can't believe this is the life I'm supposed to be living right now. And sometimes it's a challenge to show up for the way life looks today and to practice the principles, however it's looking. And so it's really a gift for me to have opportunities like this to stay on the path, to remember that I'm on the path. People, want me to be on the path. I'm included in things I get to be a part of. And that's really helpful to me. My drinking has looked a lot of different ways. You know, I had a crazy adolescent drinking, running away from home, getting in trouble at school, getting caught drinking underage, getting a DUI. I was so bad at home. I mean, spray painted curse words on the walls of my room. I ran away from home 30 some times when I was a teenager. My drinking has also looked like being married and raising kids in the suburbs, and that sort of, I can't remember who the author is, but there's an author who describes that life of quiet desperation and leading that kind of life too, where everything on the outside, you know, looks like it's supposed to be a normal and good life, but what's happening inside is still a painful life. And for me, it didn't matter what those outside circumstances look like, because inside was exactly the same at either of those times in my life. Inside, how I always felt was, I'm not as good as you. I'm not as smart as you. I don't know how to talk to you. You don't like me. You talk about me when I'm not around. You're only talking to me now because you have to. I'm never going to be good enough. I'm never going to be successful at work. I can't maintain relationships. I can't maintain friendships. My parents like my brothers better than me. Just a constant self-loathing inside. And any type of external circumstance is sufficient proof to me that you feel about me the same way that I feel about me. And therefore I can't get along with you, because I know that you hate me as much as I hate myself. And it's an extremely lonely, lonely, desperate place to be. And I'm talking about like a loneliness that has a physical pain, a physical discomfort associated with it, a chest ache, I don't know if you know what I mean. That lump in the throat, I'm so lonely, I feel like I'm going to cry at any minute, and I don't even know why. I'm just standing here in the grocery store with my shopping cart, and yet I feel like I just want to lay down on the floor and die. You know, that's, for me, that's alcoholism. That is the grave nature of alcoholism, that at any given moment, that type of feeling and thinking can revisit me, even today. Even today, I have periods of time where that will revisit me, and sometimes I don't even know why. And the challenge for me today in sobriety is to not use that as proof that this doesn't work, but instead to recognize that sometimes for me the best that spiritual looking might look like is showing up when I'm supposed to show up alongside of that, and to keep doing what I'm supposed to do until that passes. And that to me is the grave nature of alcoholism. What alcohol did for me is it turned that off right away. It worked better than anything else. Although I tried a lot of other things, and I did a lot of other things in conjunction with alcohol, nothing worked as quickly and as cleanly and as with more comfort than alcohol for me. A couple drinks, that's gone. Now I can be confident, I can feel okay, I can talk to you, you might even like me, I get really funny, you know, I can really have a good time. I can say all the things that I think inside, but I'm desperately frightened to say them aloud to you when I haven't had a drink in me. And sometimes they're nice things, and sometimes not so much, you know, but if I get some drinks in me, I can let that stuff out. And The problem for me with drinking is that it's, unfortunately, man, my drinking is just unpredictable. You know, I always overshoot the mark. I want to have four drinks because for me, four is, that's the spot where it takes me four to really get to a place of feeling comfortable. But for some reason, when I set out to have that fourth drink, it has this like magic time warping ability to be 12 or 14 or 20. And I don't even know what's happened, you know. I'm unpredictable. I can't make a plan for how much I want to drink at all. I mean, I can. I make lots of them, but I can't adhere to these plans at all. And then this other element of unpredictability, aside from this crazy compulsion to drink like a maniac, is that I might act like a maniac. You know, I have no idea how I'm going to act when I'm drinking. I might be at your wedding and be your best friend and have a great time. Or I might be at your wedding and my kids might be underneath of the table sleeping because I'm not done drinking at the open bar and I'm busy dancing like an insane person inappropriately with the groom. You know, I mean, there's no... Or I might be in the back of a cop car spitting on the plexiglass window and kicking and cursing and explaining that they have no idea who I am and I should not be in the back of this car at all. Don't they know who I am? You know, I mean, I have no idea what's going to happen. I hurt people. I say crazy things. I have been a violent person. I've been violent with people. I've been violent with people's things. I've run someone over with my car. You know, I mean, over someone's body, not even into their car, but I've run over a human being with my car while drinking. You know, I mean, it's crazy. So I'm left with this insane dilemma that when I'm not drinking, I hate myself. I don't want to go anywhere because I know everyone else hates me. I can't live successfully at all. The only way I know to feel better about myself is to have a drink, but I have no idea what's going to happen then. It might work for a few minutes, and then I'm in the jail, or I'm throwing my ex-husband's clothes out the window into the lawn, or the police are coming over to my house for a domestic, you know, violence call. I have no idea what's going to happen. And typically what happens is, whatever happens when I'm drinking, when I come to in the morning and I sober up a little bit, that self-loathing has reached another depth that I didn't even know was possible. And that's what alcoholism looks like for me. And I tried all these ways to, if I drink this way, if I only drink after 4 p.m., then I won't be an alcoholic, because only alcoholics drink before 4. And I'm not an alcoholic, I just like to cook, and I like to cook with wine, and I can't help it if I drink some while I'm cooking it. That's not alcoholism, right? Or I'm only going to drink this kind of alcohol, I'm only going to drink in my house. I'm only going to drink, you know, with this person. I won't drink with that person. And it doesn't matter, because what happens is I can't follow those rules anymore. Or I find these really distorted, crazy ways around the rules. Like, if I know I can't start drinking until 4 p.m. because only alcoholics drink before 4 p.m., then maybe I should use other substances to get me from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Maybe I should see a doctor and get prescribed something for these panic attacks that I have every single day. And maybe I can take those things until I can get to 4 p.m. You know, so that's the insanity of the way that I can manage my drinking. And every now and again, the thought comes to me, maybe I shouldn't drink. Maybe I have a problem. Maybe I'm an alcoholic. And our book talks about those ideas being readily supplanted, and anything can supplant that thought for me. Like my friend saying, you're not an alcoholic. Alcoholics are old guys in the park who drink out of bags. You just need to have a rule and drink two or drink three. You're right. That's what I need to do. Why didn't I ever think of that? You know? Or I can't be an alcoholic. I'm too young. Or, I can't be an alcoholic because if I admit that I'm an alcoholic, that means I probably shouldn't drink anymore. And I can't imagine what life without a drink would look like. And so then I start to investigate the other parts of my life that are probably really the sources of my problems. You know what I mean? Like my ex-husband, or that I don't have an education, so maybe I should go get an education. And actually, it started for me with it was my parents, so I was removed from the home. And then it was, you know, that I didn't have an education, so I got an education. And then it was that I needed to have a husband, and then I got a husband. And then I wanted to have some kids, and then I had some kids. And then I wanted to be able to stay at home and be with my kids, so then I got to be a stay-at-home mom and be with my kids. And there was nothing that I thought of that I could plug into my life that could alleviate that self-loathing for me. Nothing could turn that off. And I really became convinced that the source of that unhappiness for me wasn't so much because I didn't have these things once I got them, but it was because those things were not quite right. If my ex-husband would have only loved me the right way, if he would have treated me the right way, if we only would have had this certain amount of money, if my parents would only treat me this way instead of that way, do you know what I mean? And I spent a lot of time and energy trying to show the people in my life how they weren't doing me right. And if only they would come to see the truth that they don't know how to treat me properly, and they would begin to treat me properly, then I would feel okay. And then I wouldn't have to have this maniacal behavior. I wouldn't have to get drunk and get in a fight with my brother in a bar and end up in jail when I'm 28 years old, married single, married mother of three kids. You know, those things wouldn't have to happen to me if you would have treated me right in the first place. Except the truth is it didn't matter how anybody has ever treated me. People have been so loving to me in AA, and still I wrestle with the self-loathing, right? People have done so many wonderful things for me and invited me to functions, and I can go to the function and spend my whole time being there wondering, why don't they like me? It's insane. It's insane. It doesn't make sense. And to me, that's what alcoholism is. That's what alcoholism is. The whole compulsion to drink, the obsession to drink, the inability to control my drinking, for me, is like a pesky side effect of the thinking. The thinking is the worst part. Because eventually a time can come where I can go for a little bit without a drink. But this won't turn off. That won't go away. I can't make that go away. Even when I can white-knuckle myself through a period of time without a drink. I can't shut this off. And this is what makes me insane. This is what makes it seem like I should have a drink in the first place. Because it's the only thing that clicks that off button for me. So what happened to me is that I just turned my life into a mess, a royal mess. You know, I showed up here at a point where I couldn't work. I was unemployable. Even though I have an education from a fancy school that thinks highly of itself, the idea of going and being with other people all day long and doing what they told me to do was inconceivable to me. I was so frightened of people when I got here. I would go into stores like Target and I would have a panic attack because I would think that the other people in the store could look at me and see how crazy I was. You know, I mean, that is the level of self-hatred and fear that I was in the grips of when I got here. That a stranger in the Target checkout line could look at me and could see that mess in my soul. I was sure of it. I was getting separated out of a horrible, sick relationship, of which I played a tremendous part, even though I didn't understand that when I got here at all. I really did believe it was all that dirty, rotten, you-know-what's fault. I have 5 kids because I told you I thought if I had some children, that would make me better. So I thought, I don't know if you're excessive, but I'm a little excessive. I always think more is better. So I'm unemployed, single mother of 5, having panic attacks. I don't even know how to go out into the world and function. I had applied and been accepted to graduate school, and I couldn't go to class, even though I really meant to. I would get in my car with every intention of driving to class, and I would stop at a store because I would think, maybe if I bought myself a new pair of shoes or a new dress, that would make me feel better about myself. And I'd go in the store and have a panic attack. So I have go and spend all this money that I don't even have on my credit cards and leave and go back and get in my car and just feel like such a loser. I don't even understand what's wrong with me. I know I'm smart. I know I have an education. I know I was raised with every advantage that somebody could have. Why can't I show up and live life? I don't even know how to get up in the morning and take a shower and leave my house on time to be somewhere. I didn't know how to go to bed when I got here. I would stay up until 2 or 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning on the computer because I didn't know how to lay down and go to sleep without passing out. I know how to do that. My body had been going to sleep because I was drunk for years. I didn't know how to actually physically, mentally unwind and fall into a natural state of sleep. I didn't know how to eat. I was so underweight. People who knew me when I was first here can tell you I was gaunt. I'm 5'8". I weighed 123 pounds when I got here. You know, but I didn't eat. It wasn't that I didn't want to. When I was drinking, I didn't want to be fat, so I would count calories. So I'd get up in the morning, I'd think about how much I had to drink yesterday, and I would think, today I can eat an apple. When I got, because if I'm skinny, then I will feel good about myself. If I'm pretty, then I'll feel good about myself. And then when I got sober, I didn't know how to eat because I was so depressed. I couldn't even chew my food. All I wanted to do was die. And I went to one meeting a week for 4 months. And I would leave, I would be okay. For part of that meeting, even though it was so hard to sit still while I was in there and I thought people were looking at me and talking about me. And I didn't go to any other meetings the whole rest of the week, and there was only one woman that I would talk to at that meeting. I wouldn't talk to anybody. And I would spend my time thinking about killing myself, you know. I mean, much of my waking hours, I spent time thinking about killing myself. I had to call that same psychiatrist and ask him for some more drugs because I was convinced that I was going to kill myself. I thought about it all the time. I thought I should drive my minivan with my 5 children in the back of the car off a bridge into the river because I just wanted to die. And I was so sick. And in my mind, I thought it would be better for my children to also die than to live with the tragedy of having their crazy alcoholic dad and their mother who's committed suicide. That's my thinking. That's what made sense to me. It is not sufficient for me to stop drinking. That's the bottom line for me. If all I do is take the alcohol away from me, I might as well kill myself because I'm left with this. And until someone can show me how do I show up and live an effective and a useful life, enjoy some quiet from this, or to stay the course while it's going on until it subsides again. If somebody can't show me how to do that and I can't practice that, there isn't any point for me to be alive. Who wants to be sober with only this to keep you company? So it's really important for me to know and to understand that there's another way. That there is a way for me to be without a drink and to get some peace of mind. And that's all I ever really wanted, right, was to have some peace of mind and to not believe that I'm just a piece of garbage, not worth knowing or loving. Because that's what I thought. So how do I get that? It doesn't make any sense to me. And my big brain, my big intellectual brain wants to turn on and say, going to 3 committed meetings a week and cleaning up coffee at my home group and meeting with my sponsor once a week so she can read to me like I'm 5 years old out of a book that sounds like The Great Gatsby is not going to make me better. That's ridiculous. And telling you all of the terrible things I've ever done isn't going to make me feel better. I don't even want to think about that stuff, let alone speak it out loud. And going to those people and telling them that I know what I've done to them and begging them for their forgiveness and asking them to give me an opportunity to set it right, that is not something that I do. When I've harmed somebody, I can't even imagine that I've harmed people except in the dark of night when I'm alone in my room and I'm thinking about what a piece of garbage I am. The rest of the time, it's, I wouldn't have had to act that way if you hadn't done whatever. Right? I wouldn't have had to throw your clothes out the window if you would have been paying attention to me the way that I think I deserve to be paid attention to. I wouldn't have had to spray painted curse words on the wall of my bedroom in your house if you would have let me go do what I want to do when I'm 15 years old. Do you know what I mean? Maybe you're not like that. I hope you're not like that. That's me, you know. I don't do anything wrong. I'm only a victim who has to do the best she can after you've abused me. You know, that's my perception of myself. And so for you to tell me what these directions are and suggest to me that I'm going to get peace of mind from undertaking those directions, that's totally foreign to me. That doesn't make any sense. That's like speaking Chinese. And I don't really think that that's something that I would like to do. Except that what happened to me is I reached a point where I knew that this is what was going to happen. Either I was going to do something different or I was going to kill myself. I didn't want to drink anymore because it wasn't a guarantee that the drink was going to kill me. You know, I mean, how many times did I drink and drink and drink to oblivion only to open my eyes again in the morning to all that same garbage, only now it's worse because I've done something, but I can't remember what it is I've done. And I don't know about your blackouts, but my blackouts are accompanied by this lurking sense of shame that something awful has happened. I just don't know what it is. You know, that's a horrible feeling. And so that's the place that I reach. And our book describes it much, you know, in a great way, and I absolutely knew what it meant when my sponsor read it to me, that my choice is to die an alcoholic death or to accept spiritual help. That's it. And for me, the alcoholic death can be anything from killing myself, but it also feels a lot like death to spend all of your time thinking about what a piece of garbage you are and how you're not worth loving and why would anybody love you or want to be with you. And that, to me, I might as well be dead. That's a place of deadness inside. So, I just did the stupid things. And I thought they were stupid when I was doing them. I have a sponsor and I know I'm smarter than her. I thought it the whole time we're going through the process. Every time she wanted to ask me, do I know what the word means? I would think to myself, should I tell her what my SAT score is? Because it offended me that she would think that I didn't understand words in the book. You know? I mean, and she didn't even have an education. Okay? And she votes for the wrong political party. You know? I mean, I don't know why I just did what she said, other than to say to you that I knew that it was life or death. And I believe that still today. And I do believe that my life rests upon being willing to surrender to this program over and over and over. Even when I get to a little place where I think everything is going just fine, and I think I'm doing good, and I look back and I'm like, look at me, I'm doing good. And then I get to another little spot where I get in some discomfort in some kind of relationship, and again I get confronted with, Jen, this is the grave nature of alcoholism. You have this gross little ego that regrows at night when you're sleeping and causes you to treat people in such a self-righteous and unkind way. And am I willing to submit again to this? Am I willing one more time to do these things, even though I think sometimes they're stupid? And my alcoholism is so big that I can actively be doing these things all the time, and it'll still tell me I'm not getting better. I don't know if that ever happens to you. And I can look back at the physical facts and I can say, I've been taking care of my kids as a single parent, you know, for almost 4 years. I finished school and I got a job, and my job is very inconveniently located to where I live, and yet I show up anyway. You know, and I participate in a home group, and I have a host of friends, and they invite me to do things, and still my alcoholism will say, you're not getting any better because you still feel terrible. Look at how you're feeling. You're not feeling right. They don't feel like you do. Look how peaceful and serene they feel. Something must be wrong with you. I don't know if you ever have that experience, but sometimes I have that experience, and I just have to accept that again. That's just my alcoholism, and I just have to bring it along with me and go do what I have to do until it feels like settling back down, you know? And I don't have the capacity to just cage it like a wild animal. I don't, you know? I have to rely on, if I keep showing up and do these things, what I'm really doing is I'm surrendering to God, and I'm saying, okay, I don't know why this stuff works. It doesn't make sense to me. I think a lot of it is stupid. But I'm willing to do it because I want you to change me. I don't want to be the same crazy, sick alcoholic that I've always been. Not only do I not want to be somebody who only wants to have 2 drinks and has 20, but I also don't want to be somebody who can't get along. I want to show up and be a person who participates in loving relationships. I want to be a mom who gets to experience my kids from a loving perspective. I want to participate in friendships. I want to belong to a group. So I'm willing to show up and do all the things that I've been asked to do in spite of how I feel and in spite of how I think about them, because that's my way of telling God, I surrender for you to change me. I'm surrendering for you to change me. I've had also experience with doing all that stuff and getting really mad because my sober life doesn't look like everybody else's sober life looks like. You know, I don't know if you've ever had that experience, but feeling like, I'm working so hard. Look at everything I'm doing in AA. I'm going to meetings. I'm chairing this committee. I'm sponsoring ladies. I'm going to my work. Spending my appointed quality nights of time alone with my children. How come I don't have more money in my checking account? How come my boyfriend still lives 2 hours away from me and hasn't moved back here yet with me? How come I can't get a judge to think that my ex-husband ought to give me more money every month? I'm doing everything I'm supposed to be doing. How come I'm still driving around in an old broken-down car all my kids can't fit in and I have to double-buckle people in the back? I still live in a house that's got all this broken down stuff in it. I don't have any finished floor on my house. I have subfloor because I thought it was a good idea when I was 6 months sober to rip the carpeting out. You know, and getting so mad. And how come I'm still getting in arguments with people? I'm getting mad at my friend who takes a meeting into a prison because she didn't act right. You know, why is all this happening? And then getting to see, like, wow, I cannot restore myself to sanity.
taking these actions has nothing to do with me restoring myself to sanity. Taking these actions does not restore me to sanity. Taking these actions surrenders me so that God can restore me to sanity. There's a big difference in that. There's a huge difference in that. I am not the power. I've never been the power. Although, a lot of times, I confuse myself into that role. I imagine myself in that role. Right? But I can't do that. I cannot make my life look the way that I would like it to look. I just can't. So, I couldn't do that when I was drinking. I couldn't do that when I was an out-of-control adolescent alcoholic. I couldn't do that when I was an out-of-control alcoholic who belonged to the PTA. When I belonged to the PTA, I would go drunk to the PTA meetings and tell them how to run the PTA. And then I would wonder why they didn't like me. You know, I'm not kidding you. I would get up at the podium and tell them what they were doing wrong at the PTA, drunk. And I was mad at them because they had a fundraiser, which was McDonald's night. And I'm like, why are we supporting McDonald's night? That's not healthy. You know, we have all these obese kids in America. We shouldn't be supporting fast food as a school effort because it's so healthy to have, like, 7 gin and tonics before you stand up in front of the PTA. I cannot control myself no matter how great the need or the wish. I just can't. And it's been very challenging for me to get comfortable with the idea that it's never going to be perfection. Because I want it to be perfection, you know? And I want all of you to look the way you need to look so that if you look at me, you can see my perfection. You know what I mean? I want my kids need to always behave properly. My boyfriend needs to demonstrate a certain amount of care and concern for me to others. My sponsor should treat me with more respect than the other ladies that she sponsors because she ought to like me the most. You know, the home group should listen to what I say in the business meeting because I understand the traditions at a level that they possibly cannot. You know, and I'm exaggerating, but, I mean, I've got to be perfect at work. If I'm not perfect at work, I might get fired, and then how am I going to pay the mortgage? And if I can't pay the mortgage, we might get kicked out of our house. And what am I going to do with all my kids? We're going to go to a homeless shelter? And what would happen to them if that happened? Probably my middle son would grow up and he'd become an alcoholic and go to prison. Now, I don't know if you think about things to the level that I think about things, but that's my brain, you know? So this idea that I have to show up here and take these actions in order to surrender so that God can change what he sees fit to change is also uncomfortable. Because there's a lot of things about me that I don't like that I think should be changed immediately. I don't ever want to be self-righteous. I can't stand that I have that character defect every time I act out on it in the business meeting. I hate it even as I do it. And I've had a lot of painful experiences with that. A lot. And most recently, I was in my home group business meeting, and an extremely self-righteous point of view, I saw fit to tell another member that she was not treating us with the respect that she should be treating us. And I have a large home group. I mean, there's usually anywhere from 30 to 40 of us who show up at the business meeting. So I saw fit to just assault this woman's character in front of a large crowd. And when I left, did I feel badly about having embarrassed her or how I treated her? No. I felt badly because I was concerned that they weren't going to like me at that home group anymore. See the depths of my selfishness and my self-centeredness? I don't even care that I've made her feel bad. I want to make sure they're going to still feel okay about me. And I went to the gym the next day, and I'm running on the treadmill, and I'm just in pain, because I don't want to be like that at all. These people have saved my life, and I know that. I know that. I don't even know why I'm acting like that. I can't even tell you with any better, logic than I could tell you why I would continue drinking when I know how badly it goes every time. And I'm just running on the treadmill, and I was praying and praying and praying, and I was thinking, screw that group. I'm quitting that group. They do me dirty. They don't treat me right. They don't like me anyway. They never invite me to things. Even when they do invite me, it's only because they're compelled to invite everyone. It's not because they like me personally. I'm just thinking and saying things like that. I'm like, God, show me what to do. Show me what group I should go to. Because I've been thinking for a long time about what group I should go to, and I can't figure out where one is in my schedule. I'm praying and asking God, show me where I can be useful. Show me what group needs me. And all of a sudden, my heart started beating really fast, and I just got this incredible lump in my throat. And I could just hear the voice of God clear as a bell inside of me. And what he said was, Jen, you don't know how to be the member of a group. And you need to stay right where you are and let this group teach you how to be an equal member of the group. And I was blown away. It was I can't even tell you how powerful it was. I thought for a minute maybe I was having a heart attack because I'm running on the treadmill when this happened. And I just started crying because I knew exactly what it was. And it was such a leveling for me. And I felt such a leveling that after I felt that, I realized how grossly large my ego must have been for me to have felt such a leveling. Do you know what I'm talking about? When you hit those moments of just incredible surrender and just succumbing to this humiliation where you realize in retrospect the self-propulsion, the management of others, just the incredible ego. And so with that realization also came to me this understanding of not only am I not getting along in my home group, but I'm not getting along at home either. And I'm having trouble getting along at home because about a month and a half ago, my boyfriend moved into my house. And we've been dating for a long time. And his job transitioned, and they asked him if he'd like to move to Richmond, and we lived 2 hours apart for a long time, so, he moved in. And what I got to see is, I don't know how to be a partner. I don't know how to be a partner because I like to be in charge. And I've been running the show in this house, and there's been nobody but some juveniles to protest, and they don't really have much say when they're up against the authority of a parent. Very easy to dismiss their complaints because they're children and I'm the grown-up who knows what's best for this household. And so when I've had to share decision-making with another adult, oh man, that's been hard. And he has all these other ideas about how things are supposed to be done. And I don't really think he knows what he's talking about because I've been raising children for almost 18 years now and he doesn't have any. He brings to the table the experience of visiting my family every other weekend for a couple years. So I'm thinking to myself, you don't know what you're talking about. I don't care what you think they should eat or where they should be allowed to go or how late they should be allowed to stay up. I'm the parent. And then what I got to see is, here I am again. I don't know how to be a member of a group. A complete lack of understanding of this idea of a group conscience. And then someone said to me, so in our home group, do we tell the newcomer that they're not allowed to vote at the business meeting because they don't know what they're talking about and they don't have any experience? And I thought, well, no, we don't do that, do we? Not at all. So here again, I assign myself this position of authority and self-righteousness based on my experience versus his experience, and I don't want to let him have a voice or a say. And then I don't understand how come he doesn't want to be close to me. So
So I come to you tonight in a real place of growing right now. So if you're new, I hope what you can hear about that is that for me, what I've gotten to see is it's been way beyond just stopping the drink. It really has. It's been about learning how to not drink, and then how do I show up for all this other stuff with a level of care and concern greater than what I had yesterday. And the only way that I managed to get there is to look at some really uncomfortable stuff about myself. I mean, that's it. There's no, I don't have this ability to just become saint-like without having to have a really painful look at who I am, you know, before I can grow. Not that I'm becoming saint-like, that's not what I mean, but, it's just not, it's not been anything else other than trucking along, feeling really good, seeing like things are going good, and then needing another place where I have to look at something else and do a little bit more growing and ask God again to help me to surrender, to help me even to surrender, because it's hard for me to do that, you know? It's very hard for me to let go of that position of power that I imagine I have and to be willing to be small and tiny. That's hard. I think that's really hard. So simple, but not easy, but good. I think it's really good. Even when it doesn't feel so good, it's really good, because I don't want to be that person. When I take that look at myself and I see who I've been, immediately I don't want to be that anymore. Immediately I do want to be changed and I want to be different. What the steps have given me is they've given me a clear set of directions for how to do that. It's very simple. They show me exactly how do I confront those things that are blocking me from being able to have a more effective relationship with God and therefore with you. So when I'm really hitting the wall with another person, really what that means is now it's time for my faith and my reliance upon God to change a little bit and to grow. And the steps show me exactly how I do that. And that what Alcoholics Anonymous has given to me is a group of people who understand exactly where I'm coming from. It's like a big safety net, a very safe place in order to be doing that growing. And that's why I think it's so important that all are welcome. Because if I were to be unwelcome based on my behavior, then I wouldn't have been welcome in the last month and a half at my home group. It's very important that we can all be welcome, that we can all be safe to be here and to do that growing that we need to do. The other really cool thing that's happened through all of this stuff that I've been describing to you is that not one time through all of that does it occur to me to drink. Now that's a big deal. Not one time while I'm thinking they don't love me at my home group and my boyfriend isn't acting the way he should now that he's here and I'm having trouble getting along with people and I'm worried that people won't like me and I'm worried I might lose my job and I have all this activity happening here. Not one time do I think about having a drink. Not one time do I think that the solution is to kill myself. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. It allows me to go through this very uncomfortable personal growth, which makes my head busy and uncomfortable, but gives me this really clear path that this is what I do. I go to the meetings that I'm supposed to go to. I meet with the ladies that I'm sponsoring, and I read to them while all of this is happening. I'm just right here doing all of these things, and it doesn't occur to me to drink. That's incredible, because at another point in my life, if I thought you didn't like me, I was going to get really drunk and then call you in the middle of the night and ask you why not. You know? The compulsion for me to drink, the obsession of drinking has been removed from me. Now, that's not to say that I haven't had the experience, because I have, of being in the grocery store and seeing a new brand of beer I never saw before and thinking, huh, what's that? I never saw that. That's not the same as obsessing over drinking.
That's not the same thing as hiding a bottle of alcohol in my closet so that somebody else doesn't find it and drink it. That's not the same thing as having to eat a handful of Xanax and Klonopin so that I can make it to the drinking hour. That's just a passing thought. That's all. What Alcoholics Anonymous has given me is a clear plan of action, which I thought was really stupid, and I didn't agree with it. But having done it, I don't have that obsession anymore. So the worst thing that sort of happens to me today is that when I'm confronted with changing life situations, I'm required to grow. I'm required to change. And that's not a bad thing, even though it doesn't always feel good. I feel like I may have been kind of all over the map, and I want to just tell you about this one area where I have really changed a lot, so that you will really know and understand how much Alcoholics Anonymous works. 4 years ago, I was still drinking, and I had these five kids, and I had taken two of them out of school because I didn't like the way that their teacher was treating one of them, and I thought I should just homeschool them. I'd be able to do a better job homeschooling them, which is true for many people who homeschool, but it didn't work for me because I only... maybe 10 days of the whole year that they were home did I try to teach them anything. Because it was just too much. It was too much for me. So they just ran. They played outside that year, my sons. That's really what they did. They ran up and down the street barefoot. My neighbors told me they would see them outside as early as 5 o'clock in the morning, running up and down the street, shorts and bare feet, and all kinds of weather, unsupervised, just roaming, going wherever they wanted to go. When I got sober, at 6 months sober, I had to put the two of them back into school because I came to see that I wasn't effectively homeschooling. And they had to go to summer school and have tutors in order to stay on grade level after having been home for only 1 year. And they're very bright. It's not an issue of aptitude. I wasn't doing my job. My ex-husband and I had all kinds of just violent, gross encounters in the house all the time. And I was incapable of leaving because the idea of leaving was so scary to me that it was better to stay. And so my kids got to see a home environment that is completely unsafe and unacceptable. Today it blows my mind at how long they were in that environment. When I got sober, I couldn't stand spending time with them. I just couldn't. When I was with them, not because I don't love them, because I love them immensely, but when I was with them, they were loud, they were demanding, they wanted things, they fought, and all I could think about was how I'm not supposed to be a single mother of five kids. That is not what I signed up for. I signed up to be married. I should have been treated a certain way. You know, I mean, I was full of an incredible amount of resentment towards their father, and I felt it whenever I was with them. And it was very hard to not act out on that level of anger towards them, which I had nothing to do with. So when I did finally get very busy in AA, I would leave them at home all the time. And the oldest one was 14 years old, and I would leave. I'd go to a meeting. I'd go out for coffee. I'd be gone for hours and hours and hours, and I would leave this 14-year-old at home to be with a 2-year-old, a 4-year-old, a 6-year-old, and an 8-year-old, which is also unacceptable to me today. At that time, that was really the best that I could do. I'm glad that I happened to be in an AA meeting that was superior to other places I could have been leaving them at home. But that was my capacity for mothering. There were a lot of times where we would go to my home group on Friday night where they have snacks, and the snacks would be what my kids ate for dinner. I couldn't cook them stuff. I don't know why. It just seemed like too much. I couldn't stay organized on keeping food in the house and going to the grocery store. It was just too much. I had a negative balance in my checking account all the time because the idea of
balancing my checkbook was so overwhelming and too much, I just didn't do it. So I would just be in the negative all the time. So as I started to get a little more sober, I started to have a whole lot of friction with my oldest teenager. Because what happened to her was terrible. She was, abandoned by her real father, who's an alcoholic. In her mind, abandoned by her stepfather, who's my ex-husband. She was left to take care of these four baby siblings when she was 14 years old. Doesn't even have any kind of capacity, hasn't been given any tools in order to show up and do that job. And in our book, it talks about that idea of how in the family afterward, it talks about how mother has filled father's role. And in my house, it was my oldest teenager who filled my role. And as I started getting more sober, and I started being able to show up and make dinner, and I wanted to have some rules, and there was some wild, inappropriate behavior because my children were accustomed to being completely unsupervised, and now I'd like to step up and supervise and be a concerned parent. And they felt like, you don't have any business doing that. Leave us alone. You haven't been interested in us at all. Don't give us rules now. And there was this incredible friction with her. And I'm talking about in-my-face arguments and so angry with me. And I just thought, I can't believe how badly she's treating me. Doesn't she see how hard I'm working? I'm in graduate school. I'm working. I'm trying to be sober. I'm sober now. You know? I should be treated with this level of respect. And yet she's cursing at me. She won't listen to me. She's skipping school. She's running around with an unsavory crowd. Why in the world would she do that? She knows how terrible alcoholism is. Why does she want to run around with people like that? And I was so angry with her, and we had constant head-to-head stuff. Constant. And I could not at all understand the role that I played. I could not. I did not understand that. Again, in the book somewhere, it talks about this idea of, you know, while they may have been at fault, we come to see how we were really the ones who were to blame. I couldn't see that at all. And I have had experiences of getting into fist fight with her. Three times when I've been sober, I've gotten into a fight with her where I've hit her. And the last time, I smacked her in the face so hard, I bloodied her nose. And I was just in shock. I couldn't believe I'd done that. I was like 2.5 years sober. Maybe 3 years sober. Right in there. Sober way too long to be... I mean, I can't say I was drunk and I hit this kid in the face and made her nose bleed. You know? So here's how God changed me. And in this way, he put an outside person in our lives, which was this counselor that I started to take my kids to. And I've taken my kids there because their behavior problems are out of control. And somebody needs to step in there and help me get these kids under control. And so we started going once a week. And this counselor, in this really loving and kind way, he happens to be the child of an alcoholic who never got sober. See, and God knows exactly what he's doing all the time. Because this man could tell me about his experiences coming up with his dad, and I could hear what he was saying. And I could begin to make this really slow transference of, maybe that's what my kids have experienced. And maybe it doesn't have anything to do with my ex-husband. I mean, not that he has no part to play, but you know what I'm saying. Maybe it's been me. Maybe I've been the dominating, controlling, or completely unapproachable, disinterested, absent alcoholic, because I've been both. And how do you know how to act when that's what you get, when one day somebody doesn't care at all and the next day they want to control your every move? You know, it's hard to know how to show up and be appropriate. So what happened was we started seeing him every week, and I started to have this experience of having this ninth step with my kids every week. I sort of have this experience where we would sit in there and they would relay to me how they felt or things that had happened that I didn't even remember about or know about. And I could hear what they were saying. And I had the ability to start to see the harm that I caused and to start to meet them at a different place than where I've ever been able to meet them. And then the other thing that happened is my daughter found this church, and she started going, and she went on a mission trip with them, and then she called me up one day, and she said, I want to get baptized, and I want to join this church because I had this spiritual experience when I was on this mission trip, and I've really come to believe that God cares about me, and He wants me to be in His life. And you know how you feel about AA and how they save your life? Well, that's how I feel about this church. And I would like you to help me to be able to go there on a weekly basis. Now, this is no kind of church that I would go to. It's not. At another time in my life, I wouldn't have let her go because I would have thought their ideas were way too fundamental for me. But what I got to see is that here she is having a place where she feels a sense of purpose and of usefulness. And my job is to facilitate that. Just like I would facilitate that for a new lady who's getting sober, right? My job is to get her there. She wants to go there. Doesn't matter what I think about it. It doesn't matter. I don't have this monopoly on a relationship with God. And I just have had a completely different experience with this kid. Our relationship has just really changed. And she has come to me and told me about personal things in her life that I would have never told my mother about because we didn't have any kind of closeness, you know. She settled down. I settled down. I don't even remember the last time that we've had that type of friction. And I don't even have any type of real experience to tell you to describe how it's different other than that, like, I just can be with this kid and I like being with her and she can be with me. And it's just been peaceful and it's been nice. And she got baptized in this church, and we went, and there was this big motley crew. You know, it was this bizarre collection of my AA family, which looks like my boyfriend and my mom and dad and my ex-husband's dad and my ex-boyfriend, her father, his mother. And it was just this weird collection of people who shouldn't be able to sit together and be peaceful and have a good time together, but we can. And we could because we were able to set aside everything else that had sort of been in our history to be with this girl and to watch her have this experience. And that is a place I never would have been able to be if I hadn't been sober and hadn't been willing to be a different person. I've super gone over. I feel like I've been all over the map. I thank you for letting me come here to be with you. If there's nothing else I could tell you if you're new, I promise you that if you are willing to take some actions that might be stupid to you and it might not make any sense, that something can happen to you here that's completely different than what you know today. I'm not making that up. Thank you. Thank you.